From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, violent protests spread in Ukraine as negotiations continue aimed at defusing the country's crisis. Also, Texas executes a Mexican national in the teeth of protests from the U.S. State Department.
We take seriously our obligations to uphold consular access for folks incarcerated here.
The Justice Department charges the biggest firm conducting security background checks for the U.S. government with squandering millions of dollars of public money. And America's veterans fighting a new battle for health care.
When you release these people who aren't medically ready to return to society, then that burden becomes the communities.
All that and absolutely nothing about Justin Bieber. FSN Reports follows our summary of the day's main stories.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Violent protests still continue in Ukraine and have spread beyond Kiev to at least four other cities. President Yanukovych has scheduled an emergency meeting with opposition leaders. Yesterday's round of protests over Yanukovych's decision to back Ukraine out of a treaty with the EU left two dead and forced the governor of the city of Lviv to resign his post. Rebels in South Sudan are set to sign a temporary ceasefire agreement with the government. Over the past week, government forces have regained territorial control in some areas, but peace talks were still stalled, with the rebels demanding a prisoner release. That issue has now been put to the side for later discussion, while the ceasefire agreement proceeds. The UN estimates that at least 1,000 people have been killed and over 500,000 displaced over the past month due to the conflict. A Mexican national has been executed in Texas for killing a Houston police officer, despite pleas from the Mexican government and the U.S. State Department. Edgar Tamayo, age 46, was executed at midnight on Wednesday. He received a lethal injection for the January 1994 fatal shooting of Officer Guy Gaddis. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
Shortly after Edgar Tamayo was confirmed dead by lethal injection, the Mexican Foreign Ministry released a statement lamenting Texas's decision to proceed with the execution. By going through with the execution, Mexico contends the United States has violated a 2004 ruling by the United Nations that ordered a review of the cases of 51 Mexicans on death row in the U.S. on the grounds that they had not received fair trial. Including Edgar Tamayo, three of those 51 Mexican nationals have since been executed in the United States.
Russia's Supreme Court has ordered the release of Platon Lebedev, the former business partner of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. The two men were convicted of tax evasion and theft after funding opposition political parties. Russian President Vladimir Putin pardoned Mikhail Khodorkovsky last month, but Platon Lebedev was still in jail. Anya Ardaeva has more from Moscow.
Platon Lebedev, a former head of Menatep Group, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who ran oil giant Yukos, were regarded as political prisoners by human rights groups. Mikhail Khodorkovsky was released in December and left the country for Switzerland. It is not clear whether he intends to return to Russia in the future. Platon Lebedev is expected to leave prison on Friday, 4 months before his sentence ends. Despite the Russian Supreme Court decision, their convictions remain in place, including a court order under which the businessmen must pay over $500,000 in tax penalties.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A decision by the Pentagon to relax the U.S. military's uniform rules and allow religious clothing has been broadly welcomed by activists, but they say the move doesn't go far enough. The Sikh Coalition, the largest Sikh American lobby organization in the U.S., says it appreciates the Pentagon's gesture, but also points to an alleged culture of discrimination. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The Pentagon says it wants to give individual troops greater freedom to wear turbans and headscarves, yarmulkes and other religious clothing with their uniforms. And while the move has been widely welcomed, many religious groups say the military has not gone far enough. The shift in policy is mainly expected to affect Sikhs, Muslims, Jews and other groups that wear beards or clothing as part of their faith. America's largest coalition of Sikhs has said the decision represents a small step in the right direction, but has pointed to a long and bureaucratic process of allowing Sikhs to join the army in the first place.
The largest provider of background checks in the U.S. is being accused of fraud by the American government. The firm, the United States Investigation Services, was responsible for clearing intelligence whistleblower Edward Snowden and the Washington Navy Yard gunman Aaron Alexis. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The U.S. Justice Department's joined a legal complaint initiated by a former employee-turned-whistleblower, Blake Percival. The United States Investigation Service, or USIS, is accused of failing to provide adequate background checks in at least 665,000 cases. The firm says the alleged behavior was carried out by a small number of employees and doesn't reflect the company's values and practices. USIS is separately facing questions from lawmakers about why it cleared NSA contractor Edward Snowden and Aaron Alexis, an IT contractor, who killed 12 people during a shooting incident at the Washington Navy Yard last year.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin tonight in Ukraine, a country of 45 million people, the size of Texas, and a geopolitical yo-yo between East and West. Indeed, Western Ukraine has cities that wouldn't look out of place in France or Italy, while to the East you can still visit towns that haven't changed much since Soviet times. Violence in Ukraine extended beyond the capital Kiev today. Local officials coming under siege in the city of Lviv and several other parts of the country. At issue, calls for the resignation of President Viktor Yanukovych, first for refusing to sign a trade deal with the European Union, then for signing new anti-protest legislation into law. FSN's Anya Ardayeva is covering the story from our Moscow bureau. And Anya, there were talks today between the government and opposition leaders. How did they turn out?
Not much emerged from the talks between the country's president, Viktor Yanukovych, and the leaders of the opposition. Following the talks, Viktor Yanukovych said that the negotiations were part of a process of resolving political crisis in Ukraine, and he added that this discussion now has to be moved to the parliament. And he said that certain suggestions on how to resolve the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, the suggestions that are reportedly being discussed between the president and the opposition, these suggestions need to be discussed by the lawmakers. Viktor Yanukovych did call an urgent session of the parliament next week, and during that session the parliament will discuss the ongoing political crisis. And it seems that the country's president is taking this wait-and-see approach, hoping that the protesters will run out of energy and maybe this protest will come down. Meanwhile, the country's prime minister, Mykola Azarov, said that if the lawmakers next week decide that the cabinet of ministers must resign, it will do so. But he ruled out Viktor Yanukovych's resignation completely, saying that it is not possible given that presidential elections in Ukraine are to happen within a year.
But far from calming down, today saw protests taking place outside Kiev in other parts of the country. Is that significant? Is that in any sense a turning point?
It's not a turning point just yet, but it is certainly sending a message to those protesters on the street of Kiev, those protesters who are not willing to give up what they're doing. And it certainly sends them a message that they've got supporters in other cities and that they should stay there as long as they can.
And the fact that Mr. Yanukovych is calling for a vote next week in the parliament, I mean, that would seem to suggest that he doesn't feel there's any imminent threat to his position.
That's right. Viktor Yanukovych certainly doesn't feel that. Opposition leaders had given Viktor Yanukovych a deadline of Thursday evening to make concessions or to face renewed clashes. And it looks like Viktor Yanukovych has not decided to make those concessions. And it's very likely that we may see more violence in Kyiv in the upcoming days before that session of parliament happens next week.
FSN's Anya Ardayeva at her post in our Moscow bureau. This is FSN Reports. Edgar Tamayo Arias was put to death in Texas last night. The 46-year-old was executed after being convicted of the 1994 murder of a Houston police officer. The death chamber in Huntsville remains the nation's busiest, but unusually, last night's execution went ahead despite appeals from both the Mexican government and the U.S. State Department. FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
The U.S. State Department said Thursday that they regret the decision by Texas to administer the death penalty to Mexican national Edgar Arias Tamayo on Wednesday night in violation of the federal government and an international court. The statement echoed a warning from the State Department spokesperson Maria Harf earlier this week that the execution could impact the way American citizens are treated in other countries.
Mr. Tamayo is convicted of killing a police officer. It's not that we don't take that seriously. It's that we take seriously our obligations to uphold consular access for folks incarcerated here because we go all over the world and ask other countries to do the same thing and apply those same obligations when our folks are incarcerated overseas.
The U.S. is one of more than 170 countries to sign and ratify the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. And one of that treaty's obligations is to inform foreign nationals like Tamayo of their rights as soon as they're arrested. Tinjiwe McHarris with Amnesty International says this law was not followed in Tamayo's case.
Edgar Tamayo had a right to know that he could contact his consulate and seek support from his government. If he had done that, he might have had the sort of legal support before and at trial that would have prevented a death sentence.
McHarris says the execution also violated the U.S. Constitution's protections against cruel and unusual punishment because Tamayo was found to have mild mental retardation by a court psychologist in 2008.
We are not supposed to take the life of someone who is mentally disabled. And when we do so, we've made an act that is unconstitutional.
On Wednesday, Tamayo's lawyers appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court for a last-minute stay of execution. Their petition was denied, though three of the court's most progressive justices dissented from that decision. They cited court precedent from 2008 involving another execution of a Mexican citizen, in which the justices ruled that Texas couldn't be forced to abide by international law unless Congress passed a bill to make them comply. As the State Department, Amnesty International, and other groups push Congress to pass this so-called implementing legislation, Antonio Ginata with Human Rights Watch explained that many are also calling for the United States to follow the lead of most developed nations and abolish the death penalty altogether.
The taking of life by government, I mean, violates the inherent dignity of an individual, and it's cruel and barbaric and unique in its finality. But even if you don't agree with that particular position, you believe anybody before facing that ultimate penalty of death should have complete access to as fair a trial as possible.
Tamayo is far from the only foreign national on death row in the United States, and he was one of more than 50 named by the International Court of Justice to have been convicted without receiving his due process rights. Citing this record, the Mexican ambassador to the U.S., Eduardo Medina Mora, wrote a letter this week saying his country's whole forward-looking bilateral engagement could be questioned on the grounds of U.S. inability to live up to its treaty obligations. This could impact relations between the nations in the future on everything from drug enforcement to immigration to trade. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
The U.S. Justice Department is joining forces with a whistleblower in a lawsuit alleging a contracting company approved hundreds of thousands of false security clearances. The firm is called the United States Investigations Service, or USIS, and is also in the spotlight over its previous clearance for fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. With me now in the studio, our correspondent here in Washington, Daniel Wrenches. So, Daniel, what does the company United States Investigations Service actually do?
The bulk of the work, Simon, is background checks. It is the largest company to do this, and it has a very tight relationship with the Office of Personnel Management, which basically divvies out all of the contracts. Some estimates are that it has 95 different contracts with the federal government, and so it's actually pretty much entirely dependent on the US government.
And what's it now accused of doing by the Justice Department?
Basically, a process that is called, according to internal documents and emails that have been brought into this case, cleansing or dumping. And that is basically taking a lot of these requests from the government, to secure the background of individuals that want to work for them or want to be at a higher security level, and basically putting them through a computer without doing rigorous background checks as they are contracted to do. So the US government is alleging fraud.
And what would be the motivation for this dumping?
Well, basically, the contracts have been set up so that those involved get bonuses from the US government in order to clear more of these security clearances. So it seems to be entirely financial in order to boost the profits of the company and also to get those bonuses at the end of the year.
The company's response?
The company's response is to say this was only a small group of people engaged in this activity, and also to say that this doesn't represent either the ethics of the company or the practice of the company. But the fact remains that the lawsuit alleges that at least 665,000 clearances were falsely charged.
Now, two people who were cleared as a result of this company's efforts, Edward Snowden, now, of course, in Russia, and Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooter. Is the company in any degree of difficulty about their clearance of those two?
The company's facing an awful lot of understandable scrutiny, and the US government has already criticised the way in which Edward Snowden was cleared by this particular company. But there is still some ambiguity about it, because it appears as if the company did raise some red flags about whether Edward Snowden had lied about some of his educational achievements. As to Aaron Alexis, it appears as if they did a fairly rigorous background check. We do know that there were some mental health issues internally, but it's unclear whether those were reported outside of the Navy when he was an employee there.
FSN's Daniel Wrenches. To security of a different kind now, cyber security and a very curious internet outage that occurred yesterday in China. For 8 hours, hundreds of millions of people there had no access to the World Wide Web and found that their requests to visit websites were either simply denied or they were sent to the homepage of a US company that sells anti-censorship technology. So what happened to the so-called Great Firewall that restricts Chinese activity online? FSN's Kate Fisher spoke to Charlie Smith, the co-founder of GreatFire.org, an independent website that monitors online censorship in China. At his request, we've disguised his voice.
We don't think it was a hacking attack because, well, first of all, you know, it would require some pretty good sophistication on the part of hackers to be able to break the Great Firewall. And if they had hacked the Great Firewall, I think they would have had a better plan for an end game instead of just redirecting all traffic to that one domain, which they knew would crash because of the volume of traffic. You know, perhaps it was a mistake on the part of the sensors. And you know, one theory that we have is that, you know, potentially, you know, they wanted to redirect the traffic to that website because it had a known public affiliation to the Falun Gong. And the Chinese government also knows that the foreign press has somewhat of an obsession with the Falun Gong. And that potentially by creating this loose association, I guess, between the Falun Gong and this China-wide internet outage, that they might deflect attention from other important stories that were taking place in China. So yesterday, you know, we saw the publication of files detailing the wealth that China's leadership is hiding in offshore financial havens. And we also saw the trial of Xu Jiyong, who has a movement in China and has basically been calling for greater government transparency. A lot of foreign TV news stations were broadcasting images yesterday of their journalists getting manhandled outside of the court. You know, perhaps by creating this internet outage and loosely tying it to the Falun Gong, then the Chinese press office might have felt that this would provide a distraction. I think the only theory that sits well with us is that this was an attempt to try to block our mirror websites, which have so far been unblockable and will continue to be unblockable. You know, we noticed a change in how the Great Firewall is automatically blocking, how the script is automatically blocking websites, you know, at about the same time this internet outage took place. So we know that they're trying to block these sites. We know that they're working hard behind the scenes, but, you know, this might have been an attempt to do that or a failed attempt to do that. and that may have caused this outage. Doesn't explain why the traffic gets directed to that website, but it's really the only theory that that sits well with us.
Can you see there ever being a time when there's no longer internet censorship in China?
We're very confident that we can do that. In fact, we saw this morning, just by coincidence, somebody posting on Weibo saying that they had posted a Chinese language copy of the ICIJ report on an unblockable URL hosted in the cloud. That's an incredible thing for us to see. I mean, it gives us fantastic hope, because if any Chinese citizen decides that a piece of information or a website which is blocked in China deserves to be seen by a wider audience, they have the ability to themselves to create an unblockable mirror website. And we'd very much like to see this happen.
Charlie Smith of greatfire.org. There was mixed news today from the continent of Africa. Rebels in South Sudan signed a ceasefire agreement with the country's government. In the past week, government forces recaptured the two main cities previously taken by the rebels. More than 500,000 people fled their homes during a month of fighting there. In the Central African Republic, the news was not so optimistic. The United Nations says violence against children there has reached shocking new levels. At a special UN Security Council briefing, experts warned the conflict is having a huge impact on the young, with thousands of boys being recruited as child soldiers and girls being used as sex slaves. FSN's Nick Harper reports from our bureau at the United Nations in New York.
Trading soldiers' boots for sandals, two dozen children are brought back into society. Aged between 14 and 17, they were freed from armed groups after United Nations officials negotiated their release. Jean Lokenga, the representative in the Central African Republic for the UN's child agency, UNICEF, says they're seeing more cases of kids who've been caught up in the conflict.
The children in the camps were used for several roles. Some were fighting, some were assisting soldiers to clean their guns and houses. And unfortunately, some girls were sexually exploited.
The UN estimates 6,000 children have been recruited by militia, many of them forced to participate in the killings. Four special representatives, just back from the CAR, detailed for the Security Council the crimes they'd seen carried out on the very young. Here's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zerugi.
They have become both victims and perpetrators of the ongoing sectarian violence. The impact of the conflict on children has been dramatic, with unprecedented levels of brutality. Children have been directly attacked, maimed, killed, and beheaded.
With phrases like deteriorating situation and extreme animosity, the UN expert on sexual violence in conflict, Zana Bangura, gave an assessment that was startlingly bleak.
The participation of children in the commission of these atrocious crimes may signify the point of no return. There should be no doubt that the violence in the Central African Republic will stain the conscience of its people and the world forever.
On the ground, the African Union force sent to protect civilians is still not up to full strength. It needs to scale up by 50%, adding 2,000 troops to its current 4,000. 1,600 French soldiers are in support and 500 EU ones are on their way. But time is simply running out. And with the fighting blocking many supply routes, the UN's World Food Programme is warning its food stores are almost exhausted. Yet the UN's special representatives say there is still a chance to act, to prevent what they say is the worst human rights and humanitarian crisis of our time from sliding into genocide. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
Finally tonight, the number of soldiers discharged from the US Army for minor violations or so-called misconduct has risen 25% since 2009. That's according to an investigation by the Colorado Springs Gazette. The investigation also showed that some of these soldiers suffer from severe brain injuries or from post-traumatic stress disorder, conditions that could be the likely cause of their alleged misconduct. The discharge cuts them off military roles, leaving them without access to medical care they often desperately need. FSN's Mary McCarthy reports from our bureau in Denver.
Cash Alvaro enlisted in the U.S. Army when he was just 18. He was deployed to Iraq, then to Afghanistan, where he suffered a traumatic brain injury.
I got hit really bad October 23rd, 2009, and that was my big changing point in life. It was April when I had my first serious seizure, and me personally, I didn't even know what happened. I thought I just passed out. I thought, oh, maybe I was dehydrated. So I was in a room with a friend, and my eyes rolled back. And he said, from there, you just convulsed. Your eyes went back in the back of your head. You got tight. You were shaking.
The condition made it tough for Cash to fulfill his duties. But rather than providing medical treatment, the Army said he was guilty of misconduct and discharged him.
Just like having your family turn on you. So you put all your trust in your family. You tell them something. You want them to believe you and be there 100%. So it's just like that in the Army.
Veterans advocate George Andrew Pagani says he's seen many cases like Cash's at Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado and at other military bases across the United States.
You are taking an individual who is very, very severely ill and requires not just short-term but potentially long-term medical care, and you're sending them out into the community without an ability to have access to proper and appropriate medical care.
Cash ended up homeless and accumulated tens of thousands of dollars in medical bills. Officials at Fort Carson Army Base declined our request for an interview, but issued a statement saying they do not discharge soldiers to avoid providing needed medical care and benefits. Meanwhile, Colorado lawmakers are calling for a federal probe into whether the Army is unfairly kicking out wounded soldiers. And this is an issue that's unlikely to go away anytime soon, given the huge number of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or brain injuries. Terry Tenelian is a senior research analyst at the RAND Corporation.
And upon returning home, studies have shown that approximately 20% have experienced what we would call a probable traumatic brain injury. And we also find that about 18.5% suffer from either post-traumatic stress disorder or depression.
But Terry Tenelian says it would be premature to blame military commanders for targeting disabled veterans.
Understanding the nature of how these conditions affect those that are now going through the disability evaluation process or who are going through medical discharge and separation or who have been identified through other means is really undocumented and unknown. So I would say we really don't have very good answers about the extent of these problems, particularly among those who've been separated for other than honorable reasons.
Therapist Robert Alvarez specializes in treating veterans. He says discharging soldiers who are dealing with brain injuries or post-traumatic stress disorder is unfair both to the individual and to the community.
When you release these people who aren't medically ready to return to society, then that burden becomes the communities. And often these individuals end up in the criminal justice system, they end up in the homeless system, or they just disappear into the fabric of life, and they're very ill prepared to deal with what they have to in the civilian world.
Cash is one of the lucky ones. Thanks in part to media attention on his case, he was eventually granted veterans' medical benefits. But for many other discharged soldiers, getting the care they need is still an uphill battle. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the program. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter. Give us a follow there. We are at Feature Story. Tomorrow, from our bureau in Orlando, Florida, the Venezuelans who say they're leaving the country because of its soaring crime wave.
You don't see a future for your children. You want to educate them. They should become professionals. And they find that the future doesn't look bright in that sense.
That's Friday. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.